name Rail 3.
So the Milan started opening up from John Crossan's position, and I was blasting away with my machine guns from where I'd got to. And within a very short space of time, white flags started coming out all over the Boca Hill position. And I remember thinking then that if they were surrendering, really the sensible thing was to take that and get onto the position as soon as possible. Although obviously there was some risk involved in that. Were they really surrendering, or and you know, was it controllable, and so on? John Crossan, I know, took a slightly different view, that as far as he was concerned, he was going to keep blasting the position until nothing was moving before he exposed himself. You know, I did think this was going to be both expensive of time and ammunition. From where I could see, I mean, the position was finished, and you know, there were flags, white flags all over it. I could not see that they were going to put up, hopefully, serious opposition. So I put this to Chris Keeble and said, look, I think we've got a surrender situation here, and I think we should, you know, move up and take it. But what I want is everything laid on and on call in case it should go wrong. And communications down from the coastline were fairly difficult. It had to be relayed through my 2IC, who was still up near John Crossman. But eventually we got all that sort of squared away. Then Chris said, well, you know, before I moved, he wanted to make sure that all the sport weapons were resupplied with ammunition and so on. And so there was more of a delay. And I noticed the sea was coming in. I suppose we'd been down there for, you know, 3/4 of an hour. And, you know, I wasn't sure how long. I really wanted to sort of stay there in case someone up there had a change of mind and started opening up on us. Anyway, I came up with this sort of tall story that to Chris on the radio that, you know, if he didn't give us the permission to move pretty soon, we'd be cut off by the tide. Actually, a complete sort of load of baloney, but it just was a convenient way of trying to sort of get some urgency to, you know, permission to move. And I think we're certainly beginning to get wet, but we weren't going to be cut off. Anyway, after what seemed a long delay, Chris said, okay, away you go. Again, I sort of a vivid moment, because I was lying beside Corporal Harley behind this rock, and we'd, you know, been all discussing this, and Jim Barry significantly had been with us as we discussed the merits or otherwise of surrender. And I said, well, you know, my decision, so it looks like I'm going to have to be the first one who exposes himself and moves forward. And you know, this is what officers sometimes get paid for, sort of touch. And I turned round to my signaler to say, you know, right, tell them we're moving. And before I could move, Harley jumped up with his section and said, you're too valuable, sir, you know, I'll do this one. So I thought that was a fairly noble gesture on his part, which I must admit, therefore, perhaps left me with a soft spot for the individual subsequently, because he was a bit of a tearaway. Anyway, it all went well. Initially, no fire was returned, and so the whole two platoons that I had with me down there up sticks and started moving up towards the hilltop. Then two things happened. One of the Milans opened fire again, and I thought, oh my God, it's all going to go down the tube. If we open fire, they'll open fire, and we're right out in the open. And fortunately, I screamed on the radio, tell them to stop, and you know, that worked, and fire was not returned. And then I could see there were mines in the valley bottom between Boca and where Crossland was. So we really had to sort of detour around right along the coastline itself. And one of my platoons sort of started trying to take the direct route and wandered into this minefield. And one of the soldiers set off a mine, which sort of tipped over on his head and didn't seem to do too much other damage. It was a trip mine rather than actually put his foot right on it, fortunately. But again, it was a sort of salutary little lesson. And eventually we got up onto Boca House Hill, no fire returned, and found this essentially a decimated position. Clearly, I think, as we had moved up to take the surrender, those who were still able to move on our continued side had hightailed it, because in the distance we could see soldiers sort of literally running for their lives across Goose Green Airfield. Or towards Goose Green Airfield. And a vivid sight as well. Presumably the officer, my guess is that it was the officer who was commanding that particular position, driving a tractor, which he'd obviously borrowed from the locals, hell for leather towards Goose Green, some thousand yards away, with, about a dozen or so of his men desperately running after him and trying to jump on the tractor. And I thought, well, this is leadership from the front. And the other thing that went immediately through my mind was exploitation. You know, they're on the run, keep them on the run. Really, as I say, there was sort of evidence of carnage all around us on Boca, and all I did was I left one of my sections to sort of sort out the prisoners and set off in pursuit with two platoons, and gave the order for my third platoon, who's still back with on Crossland's position, to catch up as soon as possible. So we really took off from that Boca Hill feature in a state of some, I suppose, disarray. I mean, we were organised, but, you know, we hadn't properly reorganised. We hadn't got ourselves together again as a complete company. really, just because I was convinced, you know, they were on the run, we had to keep the pressure on. And I probably that was the right decision at the time, but it did lead to a certain amount of confusion later on. We'd been on the go, I suppose, about 5 minutes, and Chris Keeble, from where he was at this stage, could see them running across the airfield as well, and sort of said, you know, get on onto them, hot pursuit sort of touch. I said, we're already on our way. And indeed we were. Out at my right, I saw what looked like an old command post, and tents and things like that. And so I detached a 10 platoon to go and investigate that, and then to rejoin us, and I kept going by at this stage with 11 and 12 platoon, the group who'd I'd left behind on the feature of Crossland, were catching up by this stage. I set off towards Goose Green with them, essentially just, well, a platoon and a half, I suppose, to be the truth of it. I really left a section behind to, you know, look after the prisoners on Boca Hill. So fairly thin on the ground. I mean, let's say, you know, two small platoons. As we started moving towards Goose Green, high ground on our right was riddled with sort of trips for mines. So I decided that, well, really by force of circumstance, we kept on being sort of pushed slightly leftwards into a valley which led to the Goose Green schoolhouse. And the net result was we did fetch up on the Axis Road just west of the schoolhouse, facing us. And we'd seen lots of the enemy, you know, running off towards the schoolhouse, towards Goose Green. We'd seen other enemy pulling back off Darwin Hill, which had by then also given way under A Company. And a number of the enemy on Darwin Hill had also come in along the eastern coastline and headed towards the schoolhouse. And the schoolhouse had been highlighted in the orders group as a potential strong point. Also around the track, there was an extension of the minefield. There was mines either side of the track, so life was beginning to get a bit complicated. 12 platoon got themselves into a minefield, so slightly up on the right towards Goose Green. And were reluctant to move further forward. So I said, all right, stay where you are. You're in a position to provide fire support onto the schoolhouse. And I brought 11 platoon up and went slightly left with them towards the sort of outbuildings around the schoolhouse itself. Crossed the track, got in behind an old building there. And ahead of us we could see a couple of tents and things like that, and some sort of small trench works about, I don't know, 100 yards ahead of us, between us and the schoolhouse itself. So I decided we'd try and blast these out with 66 light anti-tank weapons. Everyone was panting like mad. It was sort of slightly long range for these bits of kit, I reckon, which aren't very accurate at the best of times. And a couple of the soldiers from 11 platoon had an attempt at hitting this these two, what looked like, as I say, CPs 100 yards ahead of us, and missed. And then another two had another go, and they missed again. It's all looking a bit ridiculous. And eventually, I think it's Macaulay sort of got hold of one. And he said, "Oh God, I better do it." And eventually, got one right on target, and it blew up. And, no evidence that there'd been anyone in there, but it seemed a sensible prophylactic move to have taken. And that meant we were then able to move further forward into effectively an FUP for an attack on the schoolhouse. Two things then started to happen almost simultaneously. Two 12 platoons right up on the sort of hilltop by a flagpole. 12 platoons said they could see white flags flying again. At the same time, in our FUP, we were joined by bits and pieces of C Company coming down off Darwin Hill. And at the same time, we started being shelled quite heavily by the enemy artillery. I mean, even moving down there, we'd been their AAAs being used in the ground roll had created a certain amount of grief. But because we'd been in this sort of valley bottom underneath Darwin Hill, we'd really escaped that. But C Company coming down off Darwin Hill had suffered and lost their company commander and so on, and arrived down there in bags of enthusiasm but a certain amount of disarray. And as I say, we were being shelled at the same time in this FUP, and so I called up for fire support onto the schoolhouse and was told that the guns were unavailable because they were involved in counter battery. Our guns were unavailable because they were involved in counter battery fire, which I thought was pretty perverse because the enemy battery was certainly still busy shelling us. And I felt here there was a certain unrealistic assessment of priorities. We didn't have morsel locating radar or anything like that. It was pure guesswork by the BC as to where the enemy battery was. He was wasting these resources, it seemed to me, on counter-battery fire, not, you know, without any effect. And we were still being shelled. The important thing was to get our fire onto the objective so I could get my attack underway out of this FUP, which was being shelled. And I failed to win that argument, and we didn't get artillery support. It gave us two casualties. I mean, we were lucky. We could have been picking up much heavier casualties, but the very soft ground was absorbing a lot of the damage. But certainly, one of C Company's soldiers got hit, and one of my soldiers got hit, and eventually died there. And this was a fairly harrowing moment, because it took about 10 or 15 minutes for him to die, and while we were sort of trying to get our act together. And we were all really quite helpless. I mean, we, you know, first aid was rendered, but not doing any good at all. and you could see this man slowly dying ahead of us. And we couldn't casavac him, and we didn't have the resources. We couldn't get him back to the regimental aid post because we were separated by a slope of Darwin Hill, which was being raked by AAA fire by the Argentinians. So we were there, stuck with him, and certainly the sort of, you know, the lesson I got from that was, you know, the importance of getting casualties off your hands as quickly as possible is absolutely paramount. I mean, we had picked up casualties already, but because they weren't, you know, it's sort of funny, because they weren't there in front of us, because they were dealt with, you know, they were dealt with and then were, you know, pushed to the back of your mind, and you got on with the job in hand. Here was an occasion where we couldn't, you know, here was this poor bloke slowly sort of draining away in front of us, and it was definitely a telling moment, I think, not just for me, for all the people around him. Similarly with C Company and their individual, you could see sort of, you know, people sort of, I mean, bearing in mind we're all sort of still fairly new to this, withering under the impact of this. Then about the same time, without my go-ahead, Jim Barry, the 12th platoon commander, decided he was going to go and take a surrender from this flagpole position where they'd already mentioned they'd seen these flags flying. And again, I, to some extent, I blame myself. He'd been listening to me debating with Chris Keeble, and I even debated with him about the value of the surrender on Boca House. You know, that to my mind, if we could achieve our objectives by the enemy surrendering, you know, far better than having to fight for every inch of ground. Saves time, saves ammunition, saves lives, saves everything. And he'd obviously hoisted this on board, but he'd over-hoisted it, if you like. Because before we'd gone on to Boca House, you know, I'd taken great pains to make sure everyone knew what we were doing and that we had everything on call. In his enthusiasm, Jim Barry did not. He took it upon himself to go straight up there and start to parley with these Argentinians without anyone really being aware. I got the message he was on his way. I tried to get him to stop. That message failed to get through. I then relayed that to the battalion headquarters. But clearly there wasn't the scope to make sure everyone knew what was happening. And my interpretation of what then happened was that our machine gun platoon, who tended to fire on anything that moved anyway, and without the best of communications, obviously saw movement around this flagpole position, got in a position where they could engage it, and did so. And the Argentinians, my interpretation, thought, our surrender isn't being honoured. And at this stage, they had a parley party straight opposite and a few yards from Jim Barry and a section of his men, and they just wasted them. There are other interpretations. One hears, reading Argentinian accounts, that they thought that Barry was going up to surrender to them, you know, which is hardly credible. In fact, I think the guy who shot him thought he was the man who shot H. Jones. Middleton's account of, you know, the Malvinas view. Whatever. Total confusion, fog of war, you know, a mishap. But clearly a very critical one. Barry, platoon commander, and an entire section of that platoon effectively wiped out. Weaponry 4 killed and 2 others injured and 1 unhurt. And I was then faced with, you know, well, what do I do now? What's going to happen around there? Just as the attack onto the schoolhouse was really beginning to go in. And I decided that the attack was going in under Chris, reasonably confidently anyway, onto the schoolhouse, and pulled back out from that position to rejoin 12 platoon from their fire support position, to see what had gone on. And was quite relieved to find that Sergeant Meredith, the platoon sergeant, had very, very quickly grasped the situation. With his own hands, brought machine gun fire down onto the position where these Argentinians who'd shot Barry had gone to ground and so on. Not only that, had got, anti-tank weapons firing in there and had set a bomb dumper light, which is really what redeemed the situation, because then the whole area around there became untellable to anyone, Argentinians and us. So when I got round to where the 12th platoon were, in a sense, things were under control stabilised. But we couldn't really move further up. As soon as we started to move up the hill, we started to attract small arms fire from the flanks to the right, where the rest of the position was. And also, I think, at this stage, direct from Goose Green, where we're beginning to move into sight of them, of the actual settlement. So we were sort of rather pinned down there, just sort of slightly reverse slope of the flagpole, watching this bomb dump explode. The attack on the schoolhouse went in, a lot of, I think, confusion, probably between 11 platoon and C Company, who also joined in the attack and so on. But it took place, it happened. The school went on fire. Various reports of large numbers of bodies or Argentinians burnt inside the schoolhouse. The numbers that one can't begin to guess at, I don't think. Some people suggested there were 15 there. I doubt that there was. As they started to occupy that area, again, 11 platoon and C Company found that they were being engaged directly from the settlement itself at Goose Green across the water. So decided they couldn't stay there, and then therefore pulled back to rejoin me on this track with 12 platoon. 10 platoon had gone off, as I say, to look for the command post, but sort of still out of the equation. I couldn't quite work out where they were, except they kept on getting bleats on the radio that they were also being shot at by our machine gun platoon. Corporal Owen, section who I'd left looking after Boca House prisoners, by then had got rid of them, but I couldn't work out where he was either. I think he had actually got trapped on the forward slope behind me off Darwin Hill, having obviously taken a slightly different route to us. and my company sergeant major just about joined me at this stage. So we were really in some sort of state of chaos, if I'm honest. And we just, we'd almost been sort of sucked into this chaos. You know, we were doing the job, we were pushing all the, on every opportunity. We had the enemy under pressure, but in the process, you know, put it down to circumstance, put it perhaps down to my lack of experience, but we were a little unbalanced. And eventually, I thought, right, if we get everyone together in the area of this track again, you know, we can start to sort of form another plan for moving up and taking the flagpole position and hopefully get some fire support down, and then we can move into the settlements. Shortly after, Keeble got on the radio and said I was not to exploit further forward. I think we probably had about an hour of daylight left at this stage. And I didn't understand why immediately, but it became clear about an hour later, I suppose, that he was hoping to start to negotiate with the Argentinians in the settlement to avoid actually having to attack it. I just about got the entire company, less I think still 10 platoon, reassembled, and we were told that there was an airstrike going to go into Goose Green, so we sort of sat back to wait and enjoy the spectacle. We heard an aircraft coming over, and of course it wasn't a Harrier at all, it was a Skyhawk, which had obviously been primed, I suspect was using the track as an aiming mark. Came straight towards us, cannons blazing, and I had, you know, an entire company plus bits of C company. Can you take that, darling? So there was a Skyhawk inbound with my company neatly laid up, you know, along this track, ideal aiming mark, and I felt, my God, you are a prat. And I hadn't, it just hadn't dawned on me. I think by circumstance, to the right of us, off the track, there was a minefield. To the left of us, we started getting engaged by, you know, small arms fire from Goose Green. Circumstances had sort of squashed us into this track. But, you know, I hadn't really foreseen what a lovely position we were in for any ground attack pilot. And I just had to lie there and pray, and I could see this cannon fire stitching towards us and me, and I felt all I had to do was put my hand out, and it was going to get shot off. It felt that close. And, you know, someone was smiling on us because we didn't pick up a single casualty, and, I mean, frankly, we could have seriously suffered. And after that, I decided that, you know, it was worth taking our chances with the minefield rather than staying on this track. Our own airstrike then did come in, and it, I think, probably destroyed the AAAs and Goose Green. So that was fine. Bob Iveson, the pilot, got shot down and was recovered the next day. A little while later, a Pukera came over and again started, you know, obviously using the track as the aiming mark, but by then, fortunately, we dispersed off it. Started strafe us, and then also came over and dropped a small napalm bomb. Honest, really just missed my company aid post and company sergeant major. And we managed to shoot that down with small arms fire. And in due course went and captured the pilot. Probably fairly twitched about what was going to happen to him. That was quite amusing because as it flew over, I mean, literally everyone opened up with small arms. I think just, you know, feeling that it had to do something. And one of these, or a few of these rounds, must have hit the bloke. And down he came. And as smoke began to come out of his engine, the whole company sort of cheered like a football match event. So we won, we scored a goal, as it were. And this great cheer went up, obviously sort of, you know, letting off a bit of tension and sort of relieving the tension. But again, it was just one of those sort of funny little cameos which stay in your mind. And then things went very quiet. We settled down reverse slope from the settlement behind, you know, from Goose Green itself. Nightfall came on, bitterly cold. We had probably three or four rounds of ammunition per man left. We were out of water, out of food. We still had casualties and bodies we were trying to get back from the white flag incident, which until darkness came down we'd been unable to do anything about. In fact, Jim Barry's body had lain out there up by the incident for, you know, 3 or 4 hours before we could recover it after dark. All this time, as I say, Keeble Bernard started the negotiations for a surrender, which didn't really involve me, but we just sort of sat there through the night, wondering what would develop for the next day. I mean, I must admit, I've had a gut feeling at this stage we'd won the day. Had I had any idea that there was still some 1,100 enemy soldiers in the settlement, then I must admit I do not believe that I'd have taken quite such a relaxed view that night as I did, and probably wouldn't have slept a wink. But as it was, I did get my head down, and so did others. Again, you know, yeah, perhaps we were rash, perhaps it was just this correct gut feeling that we'd won it. Had the enemy counterattacked, frankly, you know, there was virtually nothing we could resist with. Virtually no ammunition left until, you know, really just before, or well into the night when we were resupplied. You know, they could have taken us cold, really. We were at our... we were on our chin straps, quite simply, you know, physically and materially. But I think, you know, I mean, in that sense, it was quite a close-drawn thing. But psychologically, there was no doubt in my mind that, you know, I felt we'd won it. And the next morning, well, during the night, orders came up that I was to stand by to supervise or to sort of protect the sort of surrender negotiation the next morning. Staying reverse slope, well, with all except one platoon who was just to post sentries around this negotiation, when Keeble and Robert Fox went forward to meet the Argentinian commanders. And that all went through quite satisfactorily, and the surrender was agreed. I think they were given an hour to get their act together and turn up and parade, and I then lined up with my company to watch them coming out of the settlement in their little macho parade, and ceremoniously ground their weapons and surrender, and just remember standing there watching this hordes of enemy soldiers pour out of the settlement, and couldn't believe the numbers. I mean, you know, it sunk in very quickly. My God, you know, this could have been a very different story had the Argentinians played their cards with rather more aggression, I suppose, as opposed to just accepting everything and passively reacting to everything. So that was goose green, really. We went into the settlement. We found the villagers incarcerated in the little village hall and or schoolhouse thing, and released them. I, with my company headquarters, moved into the house of the farm manager, Eric Goss, who'd actually been released from the town hall a couple of weeks earlier as the sort of head honcho of the settlement by the Argentinians, and had been used as their sort of liaison man with the villagers. And I think my recollection is it was through him that we'd established a radio link, Keeble and so on, and it was, you know, he was obviously a key link in relaying Keeble's demands to the Argentinian commanders. And we were there, I think, now for 4 or 5 days, recovering, sorting ourselves out. One interesting little bit was the number of, suddenly, the number